Welcome to the Conscious Consulting Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, my very, very good and long year friend, Christina Radulovic, which we met, I think about, 25 years ago when we worked together.
Yeah.
In Belgrade in a integration project. And you've come a long way since then, but today you live in Vienna. And you have transformed yourself into a transformation and business coach. And you are specializing in achieving high performance of individuals and teams in corporate environments, which are very familiar to you because you have worked in corporate environments for a long time. You have been one of those high achieving and high performing leaders yourself. So you bring also very deep personal experience in working with clients from different industries and managerial levels. And you've been working with people from companies such as Amazon, Booking.com, JTI, Molten and Holcim. And I think what really makes you special is that you understand and change the underlying thought patterns, so you don't just stay on the superficial level, but you go very deep into the mental programming and look at what are the patterns that lead to self-doubt and imposter syndrome, helping individuals unlocking genuine, sustainable confidence. And you are such a diligent, almost nerdy researcher. I know you know so much. If you're interested in something, you just read it, you dig into it until you fully understand it. And use specifically research from neuroscience and cognitive psychology. And you focus on translating complex brain functions into simple, actionable strategies. And this is exactly how I knew you. You were able to explain the most complex situations in a very simple and specific language so everybody understands it. And I think that made you an extraordinary leader, extraordinary efficient and effective. So your work is all about equipping your clients with knowledge to master their own mind and to achieve their biggest goals. So welcome, Christina, to the Conscious Consulting Podcast.
Thank you for having me, and thank you very much for such nice words.
Yeah, of course. I mean, today our topic, and I think this is what we already introduced, is self-confidence and the brain. So we'll look into topics like self-confidence, competence, imposter syndrome, mental programming. But before I get started, I have one question. If the listener is listening to this podcast, what will they walk away with?
Okay, so first of all, I have to like be nerdy from the beginning. So it depends on a person what they will take away. So each listeners will get their own takeaways. But I really do hope that if there is one thing that they walk away with, it's the fact that that voice in their head telling them that they are not good enough and that they should not try, that voice is not true. It's lying to them. And they should go ahead and do it anyways.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I think this fear of not being good enough is something that all of us know. And I for sure know this. It's like, this is not good enough. You're not good enough. What I did is not good enough. It will never be good enough. I think we all know this. So maybe we'll start with the contrary, not the good enough, but with the definition of what does confidence mean? Does it mean that we don't feel we are not good enough anymore? Or what is your definition of true confidence?
So basically, people fall into this trap. They think that if they are not good enough, they should not really even try. Okay. I compare that with kids learning to walk. Okay. There is no child born to walk, right? And when they start walking, they fall a lot. When they start learning to talk, they talk rubbish from time to time. And it's cute at their age, right? But they keep at it and they keep at it and they keep at it and they become better at it. Okay? They start walking, they start talking. This is exactly how we grow up, right? But then at some point, we forget how we actually learn. Because at some point during our growing up phase, we need to fit into the group. Okay? And that fitting into the group comes with a fear that if we are not fitting in, then we are excluded and we can't survive. We are social animals and we need to be part of a larger setting. And this is where the confidence then comes into play, in a sense, like then we are constantly judging ourselves, comparing to others. Are we good enough for this group? Are we going to be accepted by this group? And that's when we start doubting ourselves.
Do you
So,
think, sorry, yeah, go on.
basically, confidence is the belief that we can do something. Even though we might not be able to do it right now, we need to build up the skills, but we know that we can. That's the confidence part. It's just that some people think that confidence comes after we have done it. No, confidence comes first, that we can do it so that we can build it up.
So confidence comes from action and is very strongly tied to the process of learning and failing and trying again. So
Exactly.
is it maybe that we have just the wrong expectation that we should be able to do things without practicing? Like you remember the drawing class that you gifted me. I knew I wasn't able to draw. I knew I can't draw. And then you gave me this course in neurographic, and suddenly something connected newly, and I started drawing, and I've been practicing now for more than 1 year, and now I'm actually able and I'm mastering the drawing. And that's really weird because people keep telling me I can't draw. Of course you cannot draw because you never made the effort. So does it have to do with the expectation that we want to be able to do things without putting in the effort and the learning and the failing and the hard work? Is it easier to say, well, I just can't do it? Is it also an
It is
excuse?
easier. It is easier, but the primary fear that we have is the fear that we will be judged for failing, that we will be excluded because we failed.
But isn't it also a realistic fear? Isn't it also the case that sometimes we are excluded if we are going? I mean, I remember the beginnings of my consulting. There were a lot of things I wasn't able to. I wasn't even able to like write on a flip chart properly, and I had to do it anyway. And I was in fear all of the time that my clients wouldn't accept me and say, I mean, look at her, she can't even write on a flip chart. I mean, isn't it also realistic that sometimes we just fail and being excluded?
Sometimes, but just notice what you said. You had the fear inside. Has any of your clients ever said, "Oh, she's not able to write on a flip chart, so we're just gonna fire her and hire another
No,
consultant"?
I'm amazingly no. I still don't understand why, but it never happened. You're right. So the
Because
fears are not really realistic, as you say.
exactly. Actually, we are judging ourselves much harsher than how other people see us. Okay? So just to give you an example, according to some studies, that primal fear that we have, that we are going to be excluded from the group, is so strong that more people are afraid of public speaking than of death. Okay, let that sink in. So more people are afraid of public speaking than of death.
Of death. I mean,
That's insane,
that's
right?
insane. And sometimes you could say even this fear of being excluded maybe leads to being excluded in the end.
Exactly. This is exactly like self-fulfilling prophecy. Whether you believe that you can or you believe that you can't, it's the same. You
So
know, leads to same result.
as you say, you talk about the mental programming that somehow in the subconscious lives and guides us towards what we don't want. if we rethink it and if we believe it. But where does this negative self-talk and this fear and this, I mean, being afraid of being judged more than dying, where that's irrational. Where does that come from?
Well, from like evolutionary perspective, it does make sense. Okay? Because we have to be part of the group, but we are talking about primal times. We are talking about fears that are coming from the times that we were living in caves. If you are not part of the tribe, you are excluded from it. You can't survive by yourself in the wilderness. Okay? This is where that comes from. So from evolutionary perspective, being excluded from one specific group, from your tribe, meant death. However, we have evolved as societies in the meantime, right? Like if you are now excluded, like for example, you're no longer working with one client. That doesn't mean that you will die. Of course not. You are part of other groups. But still, that fear is so strong and so deeply ingrained in us. It's one of the primal fears that we have, that it basically kicks in every single time we believe that we are going to be excluded.
So is this judgment, like being judged by others, rooted in this fear of being excluded? So if we are like criticized or rejected, that this could
Rejected.
lead to our, so we feel, so that's why we get so sensitive and so vulnerable in the face of judgment of other people.
Exactly. It's just that we are like the sentences that we have in our heads, the beliefs that we have, like you have, oh, they're going to fire me because I can't write properly on a flip chart, right? That's your thought. This is something that is happening in your mind and only in your mind. Okay? Same with people who work in companies. They are sitting in huge meeting rooms with senior management there, and they are afraid to speak up because they believe that they are going to be judged. And if they make any type of mistake, I have clients who like spend weeks afterwards replaying the same error that they made, thinking that people are judging them. Well, let me give you some news. Nobody thinks about that. Everybody is so busy. They are continuing with their lives. They don't have time to think about your one mistake. You know? And this is what people don't realize. So, for example, if they would be in the same situation, like sitting in a meeting and somebody made a mistake, how much time do you spend thinking about that one person's mistake?
No, of course, nothing. I think about my mistakes, they think about their mistakes, and we're obsessing about our own mistakes and taking ourselves super seriously, and nobody really cares.
Yes. It's not that they don't care, but it's not relevant. You know, they just get over it. They already moved to the hundredth thing that happened in the meantime.
So is it about, do we take ourselves too seriously in the end?
That's one thing. Second thing is really how our brain works. Okay, because basically if you think about it, like if you're looking at a situation from an objective perspective, meaning you are like looking from the outside, you are a fly on the wall, right? You are then able to realistically assess the situation and say, okay, this is really not relevant and let's move on, right? But if you are emotionally invested, basically what is happening, like the amygdala in your brain is firing up, basically noticing that as a danger for survival. And then what happens is like a physiological reaction. Basically, your body is being prepared for fight or flight reaction. Okay? What is happening, like you have a bunch of cortisol and adrenaline running through your system, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure increases, breathing becomes shallow, blood is sent to your arms and legs because they are prepared, you're being prepared for fight or flight, right? However, high cortisol itself, like that reaction is perfect when you are being chased by a lion. right? However, in a corporate environment, we are never chased by lions, right? So basically, that reaction is inappropriate for a given context. Okay. What is happening with high cortisol is that it basically switches off the rational part of the brain. Okay. And I mean, really switches it off. Because if you, the resources that you have, the energy that you have, needs to be invested in surviving. You need to run, you need to run fast. You don't have to prepare five different scenarios how to run away from a lion with pros and cons for each. Right? This is exactly what is happening to us when the stakes are high in companies. We get emotionally hijacked. And people in such situations are not able to make rational decisions. The worst part is they are not recognizing it. And in such state, they are making decisions and they end up being wrong.
So then they make mistakes, and then the very thing they're afraid
Exactly.
of happens. They make
Yes.
mistakes over mistakes, and then they get proof that they're not good enough, and then there's this vicious circle kicking in.
Exactly. That's one thing. This is like when the situation is really happening. And then what is happening afterwards is like we are again constantly re-triggering the same reaction by constantly thinking the same thoughts about the same event. Okay? Because basically that thought, I am not good enough, right? If you are constantly thinking the thought, there is a saying, neurons that fire together wire together. The more you are reinforcing the same thought, the stronger it becomes.
Yeah.
Okay? So instead of that, we need to build up a new circuitry. We need to replace the existing one, which is not serving us well, with something else. And that requires practice. Okay? Because
yeah.
it's crazy, right?
I mean, it's crazy. And the question is, if we look at competence, if we look, does it help to be competent in something, or are we still afraid of actually, maybe we're not as competent as we think? There's maybe before we look into solutions, I would like to ask you about a term that's used quite widely, the imposter syndrome. What is that exactly, and how is it in relationship with negative self-talk and lack of confidence and self-doubt? Is it self-doubt?
Not really. Imposter syndrome is much stronger. And if you were to ask the psychologist, they would tell you that this is an incapacitating trait that somebody has, meaning that they are really so overwhelmed that they are not able to move on. Right now, imposter syndrome is being used as a term all over the place,
All
even
over
for
the
like,
place. Everybody uses it
yes.
for everything, like the term gaslighting. So these are like very
Yes.
like terms that
Yes.
I think people or narcissism, people don't really know what they're talking about. So enlighten us.
Exactly. It's easier to label something, right? To have a word. So imposter syndrome in a very strict sense, it's really incapacitating trait. You are not able to move on. That requires therapy to be resolved. Okay. However, I understand that people also use it for like this very heavy self-doubt. Okay. In a sense, like, no, I'm not capable of doing this. Okay. So I'll just give examples. So somebody with imposter syndrome might get a panic attack before giving a presentation. Okay, I had a client who had that issue and he really had to go for therapy for it. On the other hand, like that constant self-doubt, I am not good enough, is really a self-doubt thing. And it's so prevalent. I can't explain to you. I mean, I have hundreds of clients, right? I have worked really with hundreds of people. They might come for productivity, they might come for delegation, whatever it may be. Like the background or the initial thing that I want to discuss. However, it always comes down in one way or the other to confidence. I actually had a client who works in one of the international organizations in a very, very senior position. Okay, so we started working together, and at some point I noticed that he doubts himself. Okay, even though he has achieved so much, right? And then he tells me, oh, you know, I was responsible for having a visit from UK, like from King Charles was visiting their offices, and he was the one responsible for organizing all of that and doing the entire panel with him and so on. And he still doubted whether he is good enough for his job. Like everything went perfectly well. But for him, that was not a confirmation that he did a good job, that he was good enough for the position that he had.
So I understand that actually objectively being good enough for a job doesn't really make a difference for people. This is also sometimes I sometimes talk with my clients. If they say, oh, I'm offered this job, I don't think I can do it, I'm not good enough, I always ask him, why don't you trust other people? I mean, what if this is their responsibility for hiring you and not yours?
Perfect. That's a perfect point. And this is also a point that Adam Grant made in one of his books. So we basically have a tendency of trusting other people. We trust their judgment, right? But in case of imposter syndrome, instead of trusting others telling us that we are good enough, we are trusting ourselves that we are not good enough.
So,
It's a complete paradox.
and the crazy thing about imposter syndrome could be that even if we're good enough, and the more positive feedback we get, the more anxious we get that people might find out that we're actually not good enough for this job. I mean,
Yes.
that's the crazy thing. So achieving things and being good about it and making things perfectly doesn't really help. It can just deepen our insecurities.
Yes, because the stakes are higher. Okay. I have people who are like no self-doubt or a relatively small amount of self-doubt going up the hierarchy ladder, and then they reach a high level, like C-suite level, for example. And then they start doubting themselves because they know that the stakes are high.
Oh, so the
If
higher
they're,
we go, the more successful we are, the more
yes,
anxious we get and insecure.
not always, but in some cases. Okay. So, for example, I have clients who are like CXOs, let's say, right? Who started doubting themselves when they reached that level. Or something happened, one episode at work happened that completely crashed their self-confidence, right? So if you look at it from the perspective, like when you are a junior, of course you don't know things, and of course you will doubt yourself, but everybody knows that you are learning and you're fine. The higher you go and the older you get, basically, you already have a family, you have kids to feed, you have bills to pay, right? And then you are on this very high level where you believe that you need to have all of the answers. And the first moment that you don't have the answer, you start doubting a lot. Like, am I really the right person for this position?
And this is, as you say, like, what would you say? How many like top managers and leaders have that kind of self-doubt or imposter syndrome?
I don't think that anybody has really the proper statistics.
Of course not, but
Okay.
what's your guess?
I think that, first of all, I have to make a generalization now, but at least from the point of my clients, it's more prevalent with women than with men, even though even men have it. So with women, I would say more than half for sure.
For
And I mean
sure.
high positions. If we are talking about all positions, at least 80% in one form or the other.
I have a theory why that is.
Tell me.
I think that women are brought up by mothers criticizing them all of the time. oh, you are to this, to this, to this. I know that from myself. And the sons are always raised like they're princes. Everything they do is amazing. So they're always like acclaimed by their mothers, and the women are mostly criticized. The mothers think they're doing a good thing for them, but this is something I observe over and over again, that is a total different upbringing. But that's just a sidestep. There is, let's look at the other side of maybe this prince syndrome. What I also observe is that there's the opposite, is like overconfidence. Like people are super confident about their capabilities when they're actually not very capable. I see this actually more in men than in women. Also, I saw it with employees who are super overconfident and very proud of their achievements when they're not really doing anything, when they're not very capable, but they feel they are super great and they have this kind of grandiosity or bravado in everything they're doing. What's that? How does this relate with confidence?
Dunning-Kruger effect. Okay, that's how it's called. There was a research done stating like they wanted to research, they noted exactly the same thing that you have noticed, right? So they wanted to see what was really happening. And it turns out that we are, all of us, are actually quite bad at estimating how good we are in something.
Okay.
So for let's say juniors, right? They just started learning something, but they are so happy that they learned it that they think they are amazing at it. Meaning that at that point, like they are overestimating their knowledge and ability. Okay. On the other end of the spectrum, you might have, for example, scientists who are extremely good in their areas of expertise. However, they are surrounded by people like them. So they tend to underestimate their capabilities and skills. Okay. So it doesn't matter where you are, right? One or the other way, we are not good at estimating ourselves. And that's where this Dunning-Kruger effect comes into play. That's how it's called.
So there is a discrepancy. It can go both directions. But
Yes.
what you say, it very much depends also on the context we're in, if we think we're good enough or if we're not good enough. So self-doubt could be increased in a certain surrounding, also in
For
relation to the
sure.
competence level of other people. So do we always compare ourselves with the people we work with, we around with?
Yes. We normally do that, even though the only comparison that we should actually do is like whether we are better version of ourselves or not. Okay. Self-doubt can be very, very useful in a sense like if I know that I'm not good enough in a certain skill that I need for my work. Okay. Presentation skills, Excel sheet skills, whatever it may be, right? Of course, that will then make me learn. It will make me improve in order to be better, to be good at what I do. So this is the positive side of self-doubt.
Could we make a distinction between self-doubt, which is doubting my ability to learn something, and a realistic assessment of my skill level and of my competence level, which can be useful? But even if I know I'm not good at something, it doesn't have to result into doubting myself in general, right?
Exactly. You can say to yourself, I am not good at this skill yet, but I'm going to work on it and become better. Okay?
Without having to doubt myself in general.
Exactly. The thing is, what people forget, and this is the key with all of my clients, okay? They are constantly focused on what they are not doing well or what they perceive they are not doing well. Okay. And they completely take for granted everything that they are doing well.
Why is that?
Because we are like, again, going back to the brain, how the brain functions. Okay. So everything which we perceive as negative, okay, from evolutionary perspective is dangerous, meaning like it has a very high effect high impact on how we perceive it. Everything negative has a much higher impact on us than anything positive. According to some research, for example, if somebody tells you you're not good enough, okay, you will immediately feel less good in general, and it will take 4 to 8 compliments to get you back to the original level that you were at. Okay? Meaning like it really takes a lot of positives. Why is that? Because if there is a danger, you need to react to it in order to survive. And this is still ingrained in us. Okay? So if somebody tells you you're not good enough in this, they need to tell you, but you are good at this, and that, to put you back in your original position.
Or the other way around, we get like a lot of like positive feedbacks, and then a little but one thing that could be better, and then we're obsessed with this one thing. At least this is what I do, and
Everybody.
forget about everything else.
Yes, we are everything that we are doing well, we are taking for granted. Okay? This is exactly why one of the techniques that people can do is like either writing the gratitude journal to start noticing the good things, or to start writing a journal what they did well, to notice everything that they are doing well during the day. Okay. So, for example, I have a bunch of clients who are like working moms. Okay. Working moms, really, they are the heroes of a society, I swear to you. They can do anything, right? And then they come to the session, oh, I'm not good at this and I'm not good at that and I need to improve. And I even have one client whose manager decided that he will give her micro negative feedbacks every time he sees her.
What?
Exactly.
What
So,
micro negative feedbacks? What is that?
yes, this is so basically, he wants her to improve. And in order for her to improve, he will provide on like information what she could improve until the next time they meet. But every single time he provides only the negatives, only the stuff that she can improve. He never mentions the thing that she's doing well. So basically what that is doing to her self-confidence is just chipping away every single time they meet. And every single time they meet, she's already tense, she's stressed out because she knows that a blow is coming.
Right. So that's the problem if we base our self-confidence on the feedback of other people.
We need to accept both positive and negative, okay? And I mean accept, I don't, I should rephrase that. We should listen to it, evaluate if it's correct, okay? And accept the things that we really deem as true and stuff that we want to like improve. Like, oh, that person gave me that feedback. Yeah, they might be right. And I want to work on it.
So what you're saying, we need a filter and an assessment. So we don't take it, let everything in directly, but we say stop, we look at it, and then we choose what are we going to take as if it was an offering, and we're choosing. We're also not eating everything we see. No,
Exactly.
ideally, I mean.
Exactly. But this is exactly what we are normally not doing. Okay. Normally, when we are just talking, right, in a working environment, and somebody says, oh, that presentation was supposed to be better. I expected something better, right? We are not evaluating whether it was good enough anymore. We just take that as input and we bash ourselves. Oh, I really did. Could have done a better job and blah, blah, blah. It's not only self-doubt. Normally, we just take everything instead of evaluating first everything, okay? Self-doubt just makes it worse. In a sense, like normally it blows the thing out of proportion, okay? And the thing with evaluation, we should not evaluate things from the self-doubt standpoint. That's why when working with clients, what I ask them to do is normally either behave as their best friend, in a sense, like if your best friend had like made an event with King Charles, in the way that you have done it, what would you tell him? Or ask them to imagine that they have an outsider coming to evaluate the situation. For example, let's say you hired a consultant to shadow you for a week. What would that consultant notice? What would he write in his report? Because what that does is basically removing the entire emotional attachment from the picture. And then you're doing only the rational analysis of what is really going on. And that rational analysis doesn't contain any self-doubt.
Right. So let's say what I understood so far is that self-doubt has a reason in our evolution. So it has its place and it helps us to protect ourselves and to survive. But it really does get in the way of us leading our full potential, because it comes at times where we're actually not in danger and we don't really make the distinction when are we in danger and when we're not. And we are also not able to objectively assess whether we are good at something or not. And also we depend on what other people say and believe everything they say, and we believe everything we say. And this just gets us in a spiral. So what I understood is what would be helpful is to not think that self-doubt is something that is induced by the outside or by a realistic expectation of what's going on, but it's an inside job. So somehow independent of what's going on, what other people are saying, what's happening in our workplace, our inner job is to work around reducing and healing self-doubt and see that it also, like, the re reduction of self-doubt also comes from action. And that, like, as a kid, like trying something and failing and trying and failing again. So we are building confidence in relation to a specific topic. So could we say that there is a general self-doubt that gets in the way of everything, of even learning? And then there's maybe a self-doubt in relation to a certain ability, which is okay, but which doesn't have to be like really self-doubt, but just being realistic about what we can, what we can't do, and where we have to improve. So maybe we could make a distinction, not mix up. It feels like everything is mixed together and not being properly distinguished against what has a place and what does not have a place.
But this is exactly the issue with that part, right? Because self-doubt basically comes from this emotional part of the brain. And if it's strong, then it overcomes us. And it takes a conscious effort to move away from it and look at things realistically. Okay? Because how many people do you know that really analyze a situation realistically, objectively?
It's impossible. We can't anyway think objectively. I think that's not what we're able to in any
Exactly.
way.
And with everything that is going on in our lives, we don't have time to analyze everything to a detail, right? We just go with the flow. We just accept that we are not good enough.
So we accept it. So if we move now a little bit more to the solutions, what you mentioned is we are overemphasizing naturally, if we don't pay attention, what's negative and the negatives, and we don't value enough what we are already good at. So you said one tool is to consciously notice and be aware of what works well, what we are good at, what we actually manage to do, and our achievements. So we take them for granted and we don't even notice them enough. So this is one thing to be aware of it. So what else can we do?
Okay, I need to expand on that one just a little bit,
Yes, of course.
okay? Because for that one, basically what we are doing when we are noticing, we are building neural circuitry that will keep noticing it. Like we have already a neural circuit telling us that we are not good enough and noticing only the things that we are not doing well, what we want to build is a circuit that notices these things, and it takes practice. Okay. So what I normally suggest to clients, if they want to write down all of these successes, all of these things that you have done well during the day, because what that does, we like to analyze things, right? What that does is provides like a data source. Basically, you have a pool of things that you have, for example, written down where you can actually see what you have done well. So I might have clients who start like, if they do a retrospective of a day, oh, today I did this. And then on the first day, they write only one thing, right? But when they continue writing, that list becomes longer and longer and longer. And in that case, they actually have a database showing them everything that they are doing well. And then they can't go against evidence. They can no longer say, I'm not good enough. Because evidence is just in front of them with all of the things that they are doing well.
So they can't not see it, and
Exactly.
they're feeding back, like nourishing somehow, you could also say,
Yes.
themselves with acknowledging successes and accomplishments in a structured way.
Yes, exactly.
And you say that works.
Oh, that works for sure. Okay. It's just that some people, they say, oh, writing is not for me or not my type of form of doing it and so on. Or they simply don't have time to do it, whatever it may be. So some choose to do it, some not. But in general, when they do it, it works for sure.
So let's be more specific. How often do you have to write it for how long time until you see a change?
Depending, of course, it's individual, okay, should be written once a day, depending on when, okay. Nice way of doing it is like doing it just before going to sleep, but using pen and paper, because that actually has a bigger impact brain-wise on the whole situation, okay. So just take a notebook and start writing. And normally, like in 2 weeks, they already see the change.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Then another tool you said is the best friend view, right? Like, what would I say to myself if I was my best friend? Or what would I say to my best friend if they were in my situation?
Exactly, because we just want to be kind to ourselves. We are normally very harsh to ourselves. And the stuff that we say to ourselves, oh, you're stupid, you made this mistake, you're so dumb, and these kind of things, we normally don't say to our friends when they are in a crisis. We are there to support them, to nourish them. And we never extend that to ourselves.
Right. I also
Okay?
did the practice of writing everything down I'm talking to myself and then read it out loud, and it's terrific. I mean, it's terrible.
Right?
Nothing really good is going on in our heads.
I know. I know. But
We're
this one
our
is
best
actually,
enemies.
this one actually also works very well. Okay. So I have clients when I mention this as one of the potential actions, they really try to do it. Okay. And the best part with all of this, it's not about like just being your best friend. It's about how you function throughout the day. The more negative self-talk you have, the more like stress response you have in your body, meaning you have more cortisol, more adrenaline. Okay. And again, that switches off your rational part of the brain. You are ma not making good decisions. This is always the key. Okay. So if you're behaving as your best friend, you're reducing the stress response. Your rational part of the brain can function properly. You're more productive, you're more efficient.
Let's imagine we are in a situation in our day, and we somehow, thanks to your coaching, start to notice that we are in this vicious circle of negative self-talk. So what can we do, and we are stressed? So how can we help ourselves?
Depending on at which level of stress we are, okay? If we are completely emotionally overwhelmed, okay, forget the rational part of the brain, you're not gonna get there, okay? It's not easy. The best thing that we can do is actually go out for a walk or do sit-ups or push-ups or whatever, because those stress hormones are being spent by movement. Always go back to fight or flight. Okay, you need to move to spend them. And what we do in corporate environments, we stay sitting.
Yeah. And
Okay,
then we're
that's the worst
flushed
thing.
and they can't go anywhere and they're just doing their work.
Exactly. I mean, just for you to know, the excess cortisol that we are not spending is being collected in a belly fat.
Oh, nice.
Yes, so that's why some people, irrespective of a diet and exercising, cannot get rid of the belly fat. It's the stress part.
Also, they
Okay?
need the belly fat to store the stress.
Yes, exactly. So movement is the best part when we are like really completely overwhelmed. But for me, the important part that I want to teach my clients is to recognize that that level is coming. So basically, what I teach them is to first notice throughout the day what is happening with their bodies. Because bodies know what is happening, the emotional state we are in, bodies know before us rationally. You can compare that with like touching a hot stove. When you touch a hot stove, first you remove your hand, and only then, split second later, you realize what happened. Same with stress. It first, like we have a physiological reaction, and only then we rationally can understand what is going on.
So, like, we
Simply.
are getting sweaty hands, pounding hearts, some tension in the stomach, difficulties breathing, things like this.
Yes, exactly. That will happen before you even realize that you are stressed out.
And then what? What do we do?
If you notice it, breathing is the shortcut.
Breathing.
Okay, exactly. Deep breathing is the shortcut. Second thing that you can do is either move or ask yourself a question: how is this an opportunity? How can I use the situation? Because what that does is it gives you kind of a puzzle. It gives you something to think about, meaning it redirects the energy from the emotional part of the brain to the rational part of the brain. Because our minds don't like unresolved puzzles. So whether you want it or not, your brain will start working on finding a solution.
So you could look for what's the information in that situation. So what does it
Exactly.
want to tell me, and
How
what's
can
the
you?
see then as an information point rather than an emotional, overwhelming, I don't know what to do, where to go, chaotic state of stress.
Exactly. So let's say somebody is mad at you. Okay. And of course, they start like yelling at you. You didn't do this properly. We are breaching the deadline and stuff like that. So you might get upset. This is like a normal reaction, right? But if you ask yourself, how is this an opportunity? You will stay in the rational part of the brain. And you might be able to get out of the situation by noticing what can you take away from it? How can you make it better? Okay, that's basically this executive function that resides in this rational part of the brain in the prefrontal cortex.
So what could help is to create some distance between what's triggering you and your reaction. When we all know the worst thing is when we're triggered to write an angry email or respond immediately and then put yourself in a shitty situation that you then have to dig yourself out of again, creating more stress.
Exactly.
So breathing
So we
helps to
basically,
stop.
yes, breathing helps a lot. Okay. The thing is, we can choose whether we go that through that negative spiral where like more stress, more anger leads to more stress and anger kind of situation, or we choose to stop and say, no, I'm choosing a different way of being. What can I do with this? If the stress is too much, do the belly breathing, whatever type of breathing you want to do that calms you immediately. That's really a super shortcut. Send those stress hormones, that's a second thing. And what normally my clients find interesting is just the fact how long does it take for those hormones to normally run their course through the bloodstream? So, for example, somebody upsets you. How long does the physiological reaction last? What do you think?
The physiological reaction,
Yes.
I think really long. Maybe, I don't know, 1 hour?
90 seconds.
90 seconds. Okay,
Minute and
almost.
a half. Exactly, almost. I had a colleague who was mad at me for 3 weeks. Okay, so maybe she would have replied 3 weeks, right? Basically, what is going on after that initial reaction, what we are normally doing instead of deciding how we want to continue, we are replaying the same scene all over again and every single time triggering the same 90-second cycle.
So we replay the thought, and the thought then asks or triggers an emotional and physical reaction, right? And it takes about
Exactly.
90 seconds. I heard in a brain research, I think she said the emotional reaction is about like 9 seconds or something, and we are replaying this all again and again.
Yes, it's
So
90 seconds overall.
It's not the emotion lasting, but the thought being rethought by us, triggering the reaction. And that's crazy. I mean,
It's crazy. Yes, because our brains are amazing, and I mean really amazing. So, for example, if I ask you to imagine a sunny day at the beach, right? You are able to see that image in your mind, and your mind doesn't distinguish that from the real situation that you are outside on a beach. So, when somebody upsets us, what we are doing, we are replaying the same scene all over again. And having the same reaction all over again.
Right, because the brain can't distinguish between what we see in the moment and what we replay and what's inside, what's outside. It just takes
Exactly.
everything for what it's presented. Even the real beach is an image in ourselves. There's no real beach anyway.
Exactly. So it's just a question how you use it, right? So, for example, athletes are using visualization quite a lot. For example, Michael Phelps was famous for it. He would be running his races thousands of times in his mind before any competition. So for him, when he would go to the pool, he had a very specific way of getting to the pool, right? So he would not look anywhere else, right? He would focus on his feet. Just on making sure that his feet have a free way of getting to the pool. He had these huge headphones on his head, and he was super focused. In his mind, having competitors was irrelevant. He was doing his race like he was doing it in his mind. So from that perspective, playing those images in your mind can be really very useful. But if we are using the same amazing tool to replay negative scenes from our lives because somebody upset us, we are doing it to ourselves.
Right.
You know,
So
nobody else is doing it to us.
one thing is like getting out of the victim mode and thinking we are subjective to the external world and focusing. Now, my mother, she told me something since I was a little kid, and I think it was really helpful. It's so easy, but she always said, just do the best you can, and either it works or it doesn't work. It doesn't matter really what the outcome is, as long as you do the best you can in this given moment. And that really helped me to deal with self-doubt, because I thought, I'm just doing what I can. And
Exactly.
I think what you say is like the focusing on yourself and not so much on the what other people say, do, might think, might not think. I mean, they will think what they're thinking anyway, right? We can't control what other people think about us anyway. They will always think maybe probably terrible things about us. And I think our task is not to care too much, not to give too much attention to what other people might think or might not think. We can't just let them think what they think, and that's it.
We can't influence that, right? What people say, what people think, that is their portion of the story. How we react to it is our part. Okay? So it's really up to us. I'm not saying that we should completely exclude feedback from the others. Far from it. Okay? Because some of that feedback can be really, really useful and can help us a lot. Okay? I'm just saying that we need to be critical when evaluating it, and we need to evaluate it from like a neutral, emotionally neutral standpoint.
And maybe also the question, are we offended by feedback or by suggestions for improvement? Do we see everything as an attack or as an offensive or as an insult? Or can we be mature enough to take it as an information and use it for our development?
But it's very difficult, okay? Because normally when we are upset, that means that this is exactly the part of ourselves that we are doubting.
So if
Okay?
we get attacked, if we are offended, this is because we also believe they are right. This is where we get offended the
Exactly.
most. Yeah.
Exactly. So for example, if I tell you're stupid, you won't believe it because you know you are smart and you are confident in that part of yourself. Right? But if I tell you, oh, your presentation skills can be improved, you might be,
I would say you are right, absolutely.
Right? So we know exactly which areas we perceive about ourselves as not good enough. And normally we are triggered when somebody says it.
But then I think what you said before, there's another tool of accepting what people criticize because they give us feedback. It's they're showing us areas where we can improve, see it as a data point, and say, yes, I haven't mastered the skill of presenting yet. So use this not yet instead of never, or
Exactly, or
yeah,
not
I
even
will never be
trying.
able it. To work with the turning phrase, and then we use these turning phrases that just they could be like what if and what if not, you know. I sometimes use it with clients who say this will never work, and then I say, okay, what if, yeah, or I'm not good enough, and then you can say what if not, and like yet seems to me like another turning phrase that just turns something into an opportunity, a very like small, like
Three letters,
three
that's
letter
it.
word, right?
Yeah, exactly. That also works. Okay, as long as we are willing to make the next step.
So this is also reprogramming, right? The yet thing.
Exactly, because yet thing what it does is like it doesn't stop you from progressing. Okay? What it does is like shows you the area where you should work on yourself. But it also shows the dedication. You're not saying I'm never gonna try this again. You're saying I'm gonna go for it until I become good at it.
So you say there is like a vision or intention to do something, and then there is some kind of commitment, and then you also do it
Yes, exactly.
in
So,
order to overcome self-doubt. So what you're saying, self-doubt is can be there, but in the face of self-doubt, we still can progress. So we just don't let ourselves being stopped by it. We do it anyway.
Exactly. Okay. We have courage to make the next step. We know that, for example, we are new at something. but we are willing to work at it, to become better at it.
And that's where we started, is it's the being willing to put in the work is very, and also being willing to fail is sometimes more difficult than just staying with the self-doubt and using it as an excuse. It's also kind of a comfortable place. Oh, I'm not good enough. I will never be able to do it. Everybody can, but I don't have a talent. Stuff like this. So what's the, so it could also be somehow an excuse to not even try and to not put in the hard work needed.
That's a perfect excuse, okay? In a sense, oh, I'm simply not good at it, and that's it. You know? I mean, you know me, you know my story and so on. You know that I started diving when I was 44 years old. Okay,
Yeah.
that's quite late. Or I thought it was quite late until I met a guy who was at the time that I met him at diving, he was 71. Okay, he started diving
71,
when,
yeah.
yeah, he started diving when he retired, when he turned 65. Right? So he could have said, oh, I'm too old for that. Right, and simply drop it and live like a bunch of other pensioners in his hometown. And instead of that, he was like, oh no, I'm gonna go diving. So he went to Egypt and learned scuba diving. And we all have that choice. It's just that some of us decide not to make it. You know, it's easier to say, oh, I'm too old for this, or I'm not good enough for this, and simply stay and watch Netflix all day long. Right? It's just the question whether it's really fulfilling. Are we going to regret it when we are 85 years old
So
or not?
that's the question. What is the price we are willing to pay for staying with the excuse of self-doubt? So what you're saying, self-doubt is a choice in some sense. So
In
it's not
some
like
sense,
we are the victim of it, and that's just it.
we have to prove ourselves wrong. That's it. We all have self-doubts for different areas in different periods of our lives. We just need to prove ourselves wrong. That's it. And the only way of proving it is either evaluating what we have done or doing new things despite the fear and despite the self-doubt.
So we can even, we say self-doubt, we can't, we don't do things, no, let's phrase it like it's, as long as I have self-doubt, I can't do it. So self-doubt fades and from action in the doing
Exactly.
part. So we need to get doing. And I think maybe I would be interested also in what coaches like you, or you specifically, why this is necessary? Why can't we just listen to the podcast and just do it? Okay, now I got it. I got the concept. These are the four tools or the five tools that I have attend. I'll start doing it. Why is it so important or useful in your experience to have somebody at your side?
Honestly, I wish if there is one thing that I would like to have, okay, is to show people how I see them. Because when I see my clients, when I see you, all I see is potential. Really, I know who you are. I know that you are a wonderful human being. And I know deep down in my bones that you are capable of everything and anything. You know, and sometimes my clients all they need is for somebody to tell them that whatever they are going through is okay and it's normal and it's happening to a bunch of other people. And just having somebody who trusts that you can is enough for you to move, to make that tiny first step. Because sometimes, especially people who are high in high positions in companies, they believe they need to be self-sufficient. Like if they are not standing on their own two feet all the time, right? They are not good enough for the position that they are at. And that's so not true. Again, we are social beings. We need those connections. We need to show that we are vulnerable and that we need support from time to time. And having somebody who trusts that you can is sometimes really more than enough to make them move, to make them trust in themselves. Because if they see, like, oh, this lady who basically just met me sees something that I'm not seeing. And this is exactly the truth. I am seeing the stuff that they are not seeing. Because all they see are the things that they are not doing right.
So sometimes we need, as a first steps, somebody whose positive talk becomes our positive self-talk. So we can't easily switch from negative self-talk and self-doubt to reversing it by ourselves without doing a detour of having somebody else seeing it first, and then over time being able to integrate it in our own way, how we see ourselves.
Exactly. So again, you might go back to that best friend situation, right? We see ourselves differently if we consider ourselves as our best friends, right? But we say, oh, no, best friend is not good enough. Like they are, my best friend loves me. Of course, my best friend will say that I am amazing, right? If you have somebody like a consultant or coach who believes in you, that's a person who has been through a lot of things in their lives, like with a corporate background and so on, and who is objective, who doesn't know you personally, who hasn't spent their childhood with you, right? But they still see the potential in you. They still see all of the things that you are doing right and taking for granted.
And also these high level individuals sometimes don't have anybody to talk to. That's my experience. They're just stuck in their own head, and that's never good for anybody.
Exactly. It can be a very lonely, lonely situation.
And also all they get is like challenges and also negative feedback, because you think you don't need that anymore, and actually you need it. Christina, what else did we not talk about, and what you find super important in relation with mental programming, self-talk, self-doubt, and gaining confidence?
I think that we covered actually everything which is essential. Okay. So, first of all, having self-doubts and so on, it's normal. It happens to everybody. Okay. It's just the question how we want to deal with it. That's it.
So maybe you can walk us again, just for wrap up, what are the two, three most important tools we can use to choose to deal with self-doubt in a productive, positive, and I would say way that helps us develop as in professional and personal lives?
So one of the things that we can do is really acknowledge all of the things that we are doing well. Notice them. Build that neural circuitry that will be noticing all of the things that we are doing well. Don't take them for granted. You can't be working in a company for 5, 15, 30 years and not be doing something right. Notice what you are doing well, both in professional and private lives, okay? Because that will show you how amazing you are, okay? Next thing is being your best friend, or when you are like hitting that self-doubt situation, whether you're doing it well or not doing it well, ask yourself, what would my best friend tell me now? Okay?
Great.
The next thing is like celebrate achievements. This is also the part that we neglect. We normally focus on the negatives so much that when we do something very good, positive, we just like brush it off. Oh, this is business as usual. Celebrate it. Again, that has impact on neural circuitry. That will give you a hit of dopamine, which we so much need. Okay. And it will reinforce that type of behavior in the future.
And then
So
we'll
I
want
think that these
more.
are exactly, these are really the main ones in a nutshell.
And what can you give us, like one or two really success stories from your work where your clients applied those principles and those tools? So what changed in their lives? What's different now for them?
I always remember a client of mine. She is to this day one of the most impressive clients I have ever had. Her program was just 6 sessions and she came very prepared. So her background, she's UK based. She has PhD from Cambridge in medicine and she was working for decades in research. And after decades in research, like being really a scientist, she moved and works now in a lab. And for her, that was such a huge change in scenery that she could not like manage to adjust well to it. So she came very prepared to the first session, right? How do I communicate with my colleagues? This was one thing. How do I deal with people who have lower standards than me? And then the third topic, she's like, how can I be happy with myself? I'm like, okay, interesting. Let's start working. So that last topic, how can I be happy with myself, was our third topic. Okay. And we agreed that she would make a list of things that make her happy. Being a scientist, she really did. She not only made the list, but analyzed the list on top. Because she had data, right? So she comes to the next session in a completely flat voice, like nothing happened. She tells me, you know, I made a list, I analyzed the list, and I realized that everything that makes me happy is actually related to my private life. Nothing at work is making me happy. So, having said that, there's nothing at work that can ever make me upset again.
Okay, so she took the reverse.
Exactly. I was shocked because that's such a huge insight. Some people never reach that level, you know? But being a scientist, she really approached it in a completely rational manner. Collected the data, analyzed the data, draw the conclusions. You know? So, for example, this is one of them. Okay, the second example is that person who actually like hosted a king, right? For him, it was like seeing the situation from best friend perspective. And only when he saw it from the best friend perspective, he actually realized how big it was. It's just that during the session, I basically asked him, like, imagine that your friend, your best friend, hosted a king. And you went out for beers after work, and he's telling you how the entire event went. And what do you tell him? And what do you tell him if he tells you that he doubts himself? And he says, look, you're crazy. Right?
Thank you so much for all that insight. And I have a fourth maybe tool to add is like get help. Get a coach, get a therapist, get somebody you can talk to. Don't think you need to solve and resolve something that we have like cultivated for 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
I think a lot can be done in just a couple of sessions.
Yeah, Christina, I think we covered a lot. Thank you very much for being on the Conscious Consulting podcast. I tremendously enjoyed our conversation and I took out a lot for myself. I will immediately apply everything because I'm in that camp as well, like everyone else. And yeah, looking forward to do the work and to talk to you very soon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot for having me. It was great talking with you.